We've been talking a lot today about travel, and for all the hassles of getting from place to place, gas prices, security lines, traffic, the long journey also has a kind of romance. One of our producers, Selena Simmons Duffin, has spent years at family get-togethers hearing the story of one particular trip. It began in the Rocky Mountains, continued on the East Coast, and ended up in Hollywood.
It's a Technicolor wonder show of music and mirth, with a wealth of comedy and romance.
If your life were made into a movie, what would the soundtrack be? Which dramatic scene would be the climax? But most important, who would play you? My grandmother actually has an answer to that question. Betty Grable.
Don't carry tales out of school, 'cause if you do, you're a fool.
We're going to backtrack, I guess. You want to hear about our adventures.
That's my grandma, and this is the story of a trip she took in 1939 with her best friend Dorothy. That little trip became a big screen musical called Pinup Girl, starring Betty Grable. Before Dorothy died in August, she and my grandma told the story hundreds of times.
Well, we remember a lot for old ladies, don't we?
That was Dorothy.
Dorothy Fiedelman. I'm a friend of Betty Jane's. I'm 87, is that right?
And I'm Betty Jane Simmons. I'm 87 years old. I'm older than Dorothy, 1 month older than Dorothy.
And how long have you known each other?
I was at her fifth birthday party.
We were little girls.
This story begins a few years later. They were 18 when they climbed aboard a train in Denver, their hometown, bound for the East Coast. They'd been invited to a formal dance called Ivy Ball in Philadelphia.
At the Ivy Ball, it was a big deal. We were in formals, and the boys were in tuxes.
So what kind of dancing were you doing?
Ballroom, jitterbug, waltzes, whatever, the music. Do they do that now still?
The guy puts his arm around you, and you put your head on his shoulder.
No, not really.
Oh. Anyway, back to Ivy Ball.
Frank Sinatra, who was just beginning to get famous, to say, I looked at him, we danced by him. He was so skinny, he was hiding behind the microphone. I couldn't believe that anybody would think this guy was wonderful.
Darling, you and I know the reason why a summer sky is blue.
Girls were screaming over him.
They used to scream, what'd he say?
And they literally did think he was the greatest.
We got to see him.
We weren't impressed.
They weren't impressed, so Frank Sinatra was a bust.
Well, that's our first thrill. Let's go look for another one.
Grandma and Dorothy went looking for a thrill in New York at the nightclubs they'd read about for years. The elegance, the music, the celebrities.
We didn't have any nightclubs in Denver. So Betty and I had a couple of days, and we decided we wanted to see these places. But we didn't have the money, and nobody was going to take us.
A pair of 18-year-old girls couldn't just show up at a club by themselves. They needed a date, an escort.
Bonsoir, mademoiselle.
We'd like a table, please.
Any little table will do.
I'm sorry, mademoiselle. It's regular table for this evening. All tables are taken.
So they came up with a plan to get in with no money and no escort.
We get there just before the show. My name was Bomash, and it was an unusual name. So we decided to say we were looking for Mr. Bomash's party. So we'd go in just before. We'd say, Mr. Bomash's party, please. And just then the lights would go off, and they'd say, well, you'll have to sit down. So we sit down and we watch the entertainment.
And stay very still.
Yeah, yeah.
We expected to be invited out, and we got away with it.
So we left, and then we go on to another place and do the same thing.
We went to about three different New York nightclubs. The ultimate adventure. And I kept thinking, I can't believe this is a dream. I'm living a dream the whole time. I'll never forget that feeling.
We came home and we told her cousin Libby, who wrote short stories for women's magazines. And she couldn't get over that we got away with it. We were so innocent looking.
I guess.
We were innocent. So she said, I'm going to write a story about it. And she did. The name of it was Imagine Us.
The story was a hit. The editors of Good Housekeeping called it their favorite story of the year. And 2 years later, Libby Black's magazine piece became a movie.
She made a fortune on it. And she sent us each a bottle of perfume. And I don't like perfume.
In the Hollywood version, the girls use the name of a war hero to get into the club. Then he shows up, there are a bunch of mix-ups, and Betty Grable ends up having to perform a big number on stage with the orchestra, which, of course, she pulls off flawlessly.
You were swell.
Oh, thank you.
May I have this dance?
Uh-huh.
The truth is, the movie is not actually very good. Grandma and Dorothy barely remembered what it was like. So it turns out this isn't a story about seeing your life on the big screen. The movie was just a nice footnote to the trip itself. The thrill those two girls from Colorado got from doing exactly what they wanted to do and receiving the blessing of real New Yorkers.
They looked after us. They treated us like, you know, we were important, and we just loved it.
We were little farm girls, really, to New Yorkers. And everybody always talked about how cold New York was, and everybody was for himself, and they were wonderful to us.
Grandma and Dorothy didn't fall for the war hero or become big-name stars like Betty Grable did in the movie. They got back on the train and returned to Denver to start the rest of their lives.
Within 6 months, Dorothy and Reef were engaged and got married.
Yeah, well, the war was coming. He had enlisted. Mm-hmm. A lot of people got married then.
Did you see Denver in a different way after your trip?
No, I didn't.
Denver is home.
It's far from a Hollywood ending. Just two best friends who've known each other their entire lives, reliving every detail of a trip they took 70 years ago.
Do you remember the names of the nightclubs?
The upstairs and the downstairs. I forget the names of them, but they were...
Betty Grable should have been so lucky.
That's our producer, Selena Simmons Duffin.
This month, the U.S. Mint released the last of four special Abraham Lincoln pennies. 2009 marked the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth. Not everyone is celebrating, though. There's been a long-running debate about the future of America's one-cent coin, and at least one store owner in Berkeley, California, has decided to take a personal stand. Andrew Stelzer went there to investigate whether the penny's days are numbered.
Alco Office Supply in downtown Berkeley is a completely average-looking store, with one exception. Hanging above the cash register is a sign that says, "We are a penny-free store." I wanted to find out just how serious they were, or if it was some sort of joke or a gimmick.
Thank you very much.
So while I'm here, I might get my 2010 yearly planner.
Cashier Andrew Allen told me with so many people using credit and debit cards, he only has to explain the no penny rule about once a day.
Going to cost you $15.53, or in cash terms, $15.50.
So if I give you, let's see what I got, 15, 53.
Okay, well, I'm going to tell you to keep these 3 pennies.
You won't take them.
I won't take them. I refuse to take them.
If you're wondering if this is legal, it is. While all U.S. currency is legal tender for paying debts, public charges, taxes, and dues, the Treasury Department says private businesses can decide as a matter of policy whether to accept currency as payment, and if so, in which denominations. About a year ago, Gary Shows, the owner of Alco Office Supply, felt pennies were no longer worth the hassle for customers and cashiers.
One evening I had this idea that if we went penny free and rounded everything down to the customer's favor, to the nearest nickel, if everybody was 4 cents, I think I decided that we would lose about $500 a year.
Shows says that $500, including my 3 cents today, is likely overcome by customers who remember the store and come back. For shows, it was an issue of convenience. But there are other numbers beginning to stack up against the penny. One big one, since 2006, producing a penny has cost more than 1 cent due to the rising price of zinc, the main ingredient in the coin. Then there's the issue of inflation.
It's important to separate the idea of something being used and something being useful.
Jeff Gore is the founder of a group called Citizens for Retiring the Penny. Gore points out that every year our currency is worth less.
There's just a very natural process where we have to retire currency. The penny used to be a useful coin, but it hasn't been useful for many decades.
But the penny's got some serious fans, not to mention lobbyists. Mark Weller is the executive director of Americans for Common Sense. He represents zinc producers, coin manufacturers, and coin collectors, among other penny-loving constituencies. Weller's economic theory is that if we got rid of the penny, prices of everyday goods would rise.
The alternative to the penny is rounding to the nickel, and that's something that will negatively impact working families every time they buy a gallon of gas or a gallon of milk.
Weller also argues that charities would suffer greatly without pennies. Only a couple miles away from the penny-free office supply store, Dagmar Sirota is weighing the pennies collected by a class of pre-kindergarten boys at Linda Beach Cooperative Preschool in Piedmont, California. She calls the pennies good sense.
Are these silver?
All the silver goes in a bowl, and the pennies stay on your plate.
In 2005, Sirota founded Good Sense for Oakland. Since then, she's helped school children raise more than $35,000 for homeless shelters, soup kitchens, and other charities. Today's haul of $159.54 will be donated to the local food bank. As you might imagine, she's a big fan.
Pennies are easy to ask for, and they're easy to give. And it's very easy for a child to say, will you help me support this nonprofit? Will you give me your pennies?
Charities like Sirota's came out in force to object in 2002 and 2006 when Arizona Congressman Jim Colby introduced bills in the House to get rid of the penny. The bills went nowhere, and Colby's no longer in office. So it doesn't seem the Lincoln coin will be disappearing anytime soon, leaving penny lovers and haters to debate what makes sense, 1 cent at a time. Andrew Stelzer, NPR News, Berkeley.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. A week from tomorrow, world leaders will gather in Copenhagen to begin talks on a new treaty to curb greenhouse gases and global warming. President Obama will attend the summit. This past week, the president urged action on climate change, saying that it's essential to reach a strong agreement to serve as a stepping stone to a legally binding treaty. White House officials say the U.S. will propose targets for reducing greenhouse gases and that they'll be in line with what Congress is considering. But a congressional bill is unlikely in time for the Copenhagen summit. While the House narrowly passed a climate change bill last summer, no action by the Senate is expected till next spring. NPR's David Wellner reports.
Earlier this month, Senate Foreign Relations Committee Chairman John Kerry was bullish on the outlook for the climate change bill he's co-sponsoring with Environment Committee Chairwoman Barbara Boxer. It was the same day that Boxer's panel had passed the bill without a single Republican showing up for the vote. Kerry approved of her "damn the boycott, we're voting anyway" attitude.
You know, we welcome a healthy debate on this,
But we don't need to play the delay game anymore around here.
But there are other delays. Five other Senate committees also have to weigh in with their bills on climate change, and that legislation then has to be mashed into one bill for the full Senate. Majority Leader Harry Reid has conceded he's given up on trying to tackle climate change this year.
We're going to try to do that sometime in the spring.
For Oklahoma's James Inhofe, it was welcome news. Inhofe is the Senate's number one climate change skeptic and the top Republican on the Environment Committee.
It appears now evident, which we've known all along, and that is that we're not going to be passing anything in this country on cap and trade.
Cap and trade seeks to curb global warming by capping carbon emissions and trading permits to pollute. Inhofe asserts momentum for climate change has slowed in the Senate because Americans have lost interest in the issue. Not so, says the Sierra Club's global warming director, David Hamilton.
The main reason that this doesn't have the momentum that we would want is the fact that the issue is stuck in traffic behind health care.
And with the Senate now expected to debate its health care bill until Christmas, Environment Committee Chairwoman Boxer acknowledges climate change has had to take a back seat.
I'd like to deal with it yesterday, you know, but I don't think it's means that there's no progress. I don't think it means we're never going to do it. What I think it means is that the political agreement that's reached Copenhagen should spur us on, as opposed to us spurring on Copenhagen.
So I think some people are trying to hurry the process too much.
That's Commerce Committee Chairman Jay Rockefeller. The West Virginia Democrats panel has yet to schedule its hearings on climate change, and this coal state senator says he's in no hurry.
I think it's not unfair to say that if you use the word cap and trade, that maybe one half to two-thirds of the United States Senate could not explain what is meant by that. Not a good way to sort of go into a bill of that scope and magnitude. And I know that my coal miners, the people in West Virginia, they just know it to be a really bad word.
Meanwhile, Senator Kerry has teamed up with Connecticut Independent Joe Lieberman and South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham to draft a climate change bill with broader political appeal. Graham says both sides in this debate have to give ground.
If you're a Republican and you can't agree to emission controls, we don't have a lot to talk about. If you come to the table as a Democrat and said, I'm dead set against nuclear power and offshore drilling, I don't think we have a lot to talk about. But if you're willing to find middle ground, we can get there.
Oklahoma Republican Inhofe, for his part, says he's decided on his next move.
I have been the lead senator standing up and in exposing the science, the cost, and the hysteria behind global warming alarmism. And I will be traveling to Copenhagen,
where there will be no Senate-passed bill, to contrast with Inhofe's naysaying. David Wilna, NPR News, The Capitol.
So where else does a frazzled journalist find solace? Columnist Rita Grimsley Johnson landed in the tiny town of Henderson, Louisiana, gateway to the Atchafalaya River Basin. She chronicles her love affair in a new book, Poor Man's Provence, Finding Myself in Cajun, Louisiana. NPR's Debbie Elliott took a recent tour with her.
It started with an unwanted assignment to go on a wild boar hunt in Louisiana and write about it for the Atlanta newspaper. Rita Grimsley Johnson finished the unpleasant task early and set out with her husband to explore the nearby Atchafalaya.
This is Basin Landing Marina.
We're walking along a maze of boardwalks lining Henderson
Swamp. Here she is.
She's pointing to one of the houseboats tucked beneath the moss-draped cypress and willow trees.
We saw the boat with the two signs. One said Green Queen, the other said For Sale. And it began our great adventure.
Before long, they decided to make the Green Queen their second home of sorts.
It's a shanty boat. It's not a fancy houseboat, yacht kind of affair. It's one room, and it's the color of an after-dinner mint. And it's got vinyl siding and faux shutters, and it's all green, very green.
Here, floating on the hydrilla-covered swamp, Johnson says she felt a curious connection.
That I had seen it before in some previous life, that it was something so familiar yet strange. It was as if I had been here before and left and come back.
If it was the swamp that drew her, it was the people of Henderson that kept her coming back for more than 10 years now.
But there was this unusual, almost anachronistic connection to the land that reminded me of my grandparents'
peanut farming in South Georgia. It was a way of life that few have anymore. They prized time over money and family and friends over almost anything else, and I think they got it right.
Entree my house. Entree for my cabin. You understand, I live in the woods where there's nothing fancy.
We've come to meet Helen Boudreau, a main character in the book. She's the Cajun French Music Association's Female Vocalist of the Year, but folks around here know her by another title.
Catahoula Truck Driving Cajun Mama.
Boudreau is a retired long-distance truck driver turned singer-songwriter. Her latest song is an ode to the town she grew up in.
This is my song about Catahoula, my roots, and I'm going to start it in French, then go into English. La Bassine. Papa was a sugarcane farmer. We slept four in a bed. We had cracks. We had a sharecropper house. We had cracks in our floors. We'd feed corn to the chickens under the house. When everybody'd be sleeping, I'd raise the window to the bedroom at 12, 1 o'clock in the morning, and I'd listen to the panthers in the woods. And I was all by myself in my own little world, you know.
Beautiful Catahoula sits right on the edge of that swamp. Oh, my tree and my branches are gone now. My roots and my heart still belong.
People from all over Acadiana come to see Boudreau for her other calling.
What they call a traiteur, a faith healer. The Attakapaw, the Indians, lived here before the Acadians and the Europeans came. So these prayers were theirs. And when they married into the Acadians and the Europeans, well, they passed their prayers down. The ones I have from my old land, that's 300 years of prayers.
She has a special chant for just about anything that ails you.
No, a wart prayer. For warts? For a female, you say, piglet, 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 and tap the wart. Piglet, 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 tap the wart. And if it's a male, it's pigri, 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 tap the wart.
While Poor Man's Provence captures unique characters like Helen Boudreau, it also gives an honest look at life in this working-class town, where front yards are dotted with statues of the Virgin Mary and motorboats. Rita Gremsley Johnson writes that Henderson is junky, unplanned, littered, and she doesn't shy away from what she calls the sadder parts of the culture, the poverty and child abuse she witnesses. Back on the porch of the Green Queen houseboat, Johnson peers out over the water and reads a passage from her book about evolution and the swamp.
Something begins to bubble beneath the green carpet of hydrilla, unseen proof of life. Something else, a nutria or muskrat, slithers from water to land with a beginner's grace. There's movement in the tall grass. A heron with awkward legs crashes about at the edge of the chafalaya. A turtle plops from a log with a satisfying splash. The snowy egret dangles from a willow limb like a bowl of unpicked cotton. You also see the big tracks of Homo sapiens, abandoned pipelines and litter and oil streaks across the bio's slick surface. The connection between our species and all the others is never so clear as while floating on Henderson Swamp in early morning light. We are a higher species with low-down habits.
And all of us still have mud on our backs, she says. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.